Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. It is Tuesday, May 20th. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. The U.S. Army has indicated it's willing to let some of its land leases expire in 2029, essentially giving up two out of three training areas it has held here on Oahu. That was included in an environmental impact study published on Friday. We hear from the Army staff and from a key stakeholder about the decision by the military to let go of part of Makua Valley on Oahu's west side. A labeling bill that's meant to regulate the mamaki tea industry has farmers worried it could be a double-edged sword. And we continue to explore Hula for Health. Breast cancer survivors make up a halau that's been around for a decade now. How a research study became a community for dozens. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A week after a brutal seven-hour public hearing before the State Land Board over the military's land lease at Pohakaloa on the Big Island, the U.S. Army released a report signaling it was considering drastically pulling back on its footprint here on Oahu. HBR first reported that the Army planned to publish the environmental impact statement on Friday. We spoke with Alice Roberts. She's the program manager for U.S. Army Pacific Land Retention.
It's important to remember that the environmental impact statements that we have produced are only identifying how much land the Army seeks to retain. Mm-hmm. It does not decide how it retains it. And that was intentional so that we could go into good faith negotiation to determine whether a lease or a fee acquisition or a land exchange. In rejecting the EIS for Pohakaloa, that just removes a lease option out of the equation. So the Army currently leases approximately 6,300 acres on Oahu that are across three installations, one of which is Makua Military Reservation in Waianae. The Army currently leases 782 acres from the state of Hawaii at the mouth of the Makua Valley. In the draft EIS, we had considered a portion would be retained. In the final EIS, the Army has identified the no action alternative. So those lands, the 782 acres, would revert to the state in 2029.
So no move to re-up those leases at all?
At Makua, no. At Poamoho, it's not used for ground training. Currently, there's helicopter overflights, but there's no infrastructure, and the eastern portion of it has already been designated a natural area reserve. And so the Army is not seeking to retain any of that.
And so at this point, the only other lease is that at Kahuku, and you still do want to retain some of that for future training.
Right. There is a parcel that is about 700 acres that is up. It's accessed from like Pupukea. That will be returned. It's currently essentially in a forest reserve also. There's very little infrastructure. And then there's a 450-acre parcel, the Makai parcel, that is closer to the Sunset Beach community. And that also contains the motocross track. That parcel, the Army is seeking to retain. So out of the 6,300 acres currently leased by the Army from the state of Hawaii, approximately 450 acres are sought for retention.
And the whole idea of keeping the Kahuku motocross?
Well, I mean, that is one egress for the Army to get into the property. It's also, it's bound on three sides by federal lands that were not executive order. They were purchased from the Campbell estate. So for that, for continuity in the range, it makes the most sense to retain that. But we just want to assure the community, particularly the motocross community, that the use of that will continue as it is.
So really, you are scaling back the footprint dramatically here on Oahu. And, you know, I know at Makua that has been a source of contention for the community, and they have worked with the Army to halt the live fire training. And I believe it was last year that the Army indicated that it was not part of their plan to continue to do live firing. And that was a big deal to the community at the time.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of this, bear in mind that the Army has faced decades of litigation at Makua to first to get the Army to conduct and complete an environmental impact statement, but there was subsequent litigation on that, and it became then that, well, it's just become obvious over time that it was going to be very difficult to in any way try to return to that state. So in all of this process, yes, a deliberate decision was made in October of 2023 to no longer pursue live fire at Makua. So not now or in the future.
So I have to ask, what happens then with cleanup? Because I know when the community groups get access, you know, for cultural practices, that, you know, you have to be careful of where you go.
Right.
Because of the previous uses of the land. So what happens with the cleanup?
So the Army has already done a preliminary assessment of the state-owned lands for the UXO and for cleanup. I'm not prepared to go into details of that today. There would be more information available about that once we get through the record of decision. Just it's part of the Army's plan to complete that cleanup and have that. Like, the timeline for that is not completely set. Let me just put it that way. But as soon as we hit the record of decision, and then we can start looking at how we're going to complete that, and then we can work with the state on that as well. So it's something we're already thinking about and working on.
And, you know, I know in the past, in covering, you know, the controversies back and forth, and I think even at one time there was a fire because of the live training exercises that happened there. But again, that has all been resolved with a decision to halt any future exercises like that.
Right. Live fire hasn't been conducted at Makua in over 20 years. So it's been a long time. This is while the Army was in litigation. And because of all of that and the back and forth and continuing to work on access issues, it was just decided that, you know, we would just take live fire off the table permanently at Makua.
Is that a symbolic gesture of the Army that it's pulling back in those areas?
I think it's a thoughtful decision by the Army to consider the input of the community, of stakeholders, of taking a very hard and deliberate look at the land utilization and coming to a determination that the Army can continue to meet their readiness and warfighter capabilities without retaining that land.
And then what else do you want to say about the process for the Oahu leases?
So when we published the draft EIS, we did a series of public meetings. So those were held in Waianae, Kahuku, and Wahiwa. We had probably about 600 substantive comments. Those have been addressed and it put into the final EIS. We're in a 30-day waiting period. So it's not really a public comment period. It is a waiting period for the Land Division staff who will make their recommendation to the board. But we continue to meet with stakeholders, but we're not going through any sort of other public involvement process.
You know, you have just come off a 7-hour hearing on the Pohakaloa leases. You know, the board rejected it and they found that the EIS was deficient. What do you want to say about those deficiencies?
We respect the board's decision. I would like to assert that I believe that the document is HEPA compliant. I think that the characterization of our natural and cultural resources programs was very unfortunate. There's some critical documents that support the EIS that will demonstrate that, and we are just recommending that people go and look at the information. There's just an incredible amount of work that goes into the biological surveys that are ongoing annually that are conducted at Pohakaloa to continue to protect 26 threatened and endangered species, 37,000 acres of fenced conservation units, And I just found that almost heartbreaking, honestly, that there was kind of a disregard for that work that is currently being done.
And there was some criticism about reports that were lacking on some of the, I don't know if it was EBI or cultural resources that were removed. I had read that there had been some deference to family members, lineal descendants. Anything you want to clarify on that?
Well, I think that's another unfortunate situation in that, you know, the Army works with over 40 consulting parties at Pohakoloa for cultural resources. And they have a group who have a joint claim for the Moipu that they had made it an explicit request that they not be discussed or photographed or shared with others. And the Army honored that request. And that is not unusual for items that are covered under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. And there has been ongoing dialogue with the State Historic Preservation Division since the find was initially found. It was reported. It was reported to OHA. So I just find it really unfortunate that it's been characterized that somehow we've withheld some information because we have provided everything to the State Historic Preservation Division. There was an artifact inventory that the chair cited a number of times during the hearing that they didn't get that till March 25th. Well, the staff hadn't requested it until February of 2025. And that's already information that is included in reports that are on file at the State Historic Preservation Division. So I think there was just some unnecessary confusion. And it just doesn't look at the totality of what is reported in the EIS. And that's what I think is unfortunate.
That was Alice Roberts, U.S. Army Pacific Land Retention Program Manager. She again urges people to read the EIS to see what's been included in its studies over the years. We'll have a link to it on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Storytelling. It's an essential part of every society. In Hawaii, we know this well. Our families and ancestors have shown us how stories help share wisdom, foster new ideas, and bring people together. Help ensure Hawaii stories thrive on Hawaii Public Radio. Stand up for HPR and for public media. Learn how at hawaiipublicradio.org/protect.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, being a documentary filmmaker used to mean taking a vow of poverty. Then came streaming.
I'm told between 30 and 40 million people saw that movie.
We talked with the filmmaker R.J. Cutler, who's behind some of the biggest documentary films in recent years. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Beginning this evening at 7.
This morning, we also heard from William Isla about the land leases. Isla served as the former state land board chairman and had worked with the group Malama Makua in its early fight against the Army to halt the bombing of the valley. He is now with Hui Malama o Makua.
Well, it's personal to me because in the late 1980s, an uncle Ivanhoe Na'ivi, who was born and raised in Makua Valley, asked me to come and assist with their efforts to gain return of the valley. And this was shortly after the 1964 signing of a new lease. So the Army actually had the land prior to that, and their lease was expiring in 1964. And they were doing the very same thing that this process was to apply for a new lease. And unfortunately, they were not able to stop that effort. and a new lease was issued, again, for $1 for the entire 65-year lease. So I became involved. Some other folks became involved and created Malama Makua. Another group created Hui Malama Makua, which is the sort of protectors of the cultural resources and the spiritual resources of Makua. And then Malama Makua took the battle to the courts and took the legal side. And we're very successful in stopping training for close to 28 years now. So through their court action, the Army really proved that they didn't need to train in Makua Valley. And I think that played a big part in this decision to give the state portion of it back. Now, their only justification for keeping the remaining two-thirds of the Upper Valley is that they need to conduct UAV training and helicopter training. And that is not true. They can continue those operations on the lands that, the federal lands that they continue to maintain. So the ask and the desire for the Wai'anae community to have the entire valley back to be rehabilitated, I guess is the best way to say it, both spiritually, culturally, and physically, is the preferred option for the community. We'd like the whole valley back, and we'd like the Army to come up with an endowment so that we can continue the cleanup effort on a more long-term basis and the restoration of native plants and endangered species on a more long-term basis. That's the real plan that the community wants. And right now, again, the Army is only justification for maintaining or trying to retain the top two-thirds is for helicopter training and these drone flight trainings, which they can do on the other lands that they already have.
And you're talking lands over at what, Kahuku?
We're talking lands at Kahuku, the balance of the lands at Pamoho, the balance of the lands in Schofield, Wheeler, and even Pu'akuloa.
I don't know if you expected this preferred outcome, you know, that they were willing to give up these leases. Did it surprise you?
It did not surprise me. It surprised a lot of other folks because I know that we had applied pressure on the Army, you know, since the late 1980s that I've been involved in Malama Makua and Hui Malama has been pushing our efforts. So the state portion doesn't come as a surprise to me because we also put pressure on the state not to renew the leases for the state lands. The Army just proved that they have wants more than they have needs. And so the needs for Makua Valley, after not training there for almost 28 plus years, showed that they really didn't need it because they went off and fought two wars and many other conflicts in the world, and they did not need Makua Valley. So it doesn't come as a surprise for me. What comes as a surprise for me is their desire, their want, not need, their want to hold on the top two-thirds of the valley. That's surprising to me. Because as we know, they have plenty of other places that they can train the helicopters and the UAVs on.
So in your mind, there's not enough justification for them to hold on to the upper part of the valley?
Not at all. And I think the EIS doesn't make a strong case for that because the EIS doesn't analyze whether they can train at a successful rate at the other facilities, those two services that they want, the helicopter training and the UAVs.
Can we talk about access? Because I know that was something that was really important to Malama Makua back in the day, and you were able to get access to Makua. I think it's every month, correct?
Every month, once a month, and twice a year for Makahiki ceremonies. That was part of the court settlement back in 2001. So we have been entering the valley. We have been identifying with the help of the Army and maintaining many of the cultural sites which still exist today, thankfully. And we will continue to do that even in the areas where the Army continues to hopefully train with the UAVs because the court settlement doesn't go away.
My question, though, is the access for the public to go up there once a month, is that included in the areas that the military is has indicated it may be willing to give up?
It has indicated that it's willing to continue the accesses on the non-state land, right? So the state land will come back. We'll have to work with the land board on how to continue access on the bottom one-third of Makua Valley. And then now we're talking about how do we maintain balance? How do we maintain access in the upper two-thirds region, which they have committed to continue? They also have agreements with Fish and Wildlife Service to provide certain restoration services and fire prevention services to protect certain and endangered plants, snails, and bats that continue to be in the upper region.
Well, you mentioned fires, and I know over the years they've had control burns, I think, that got out of control or may have been ignited. And we do hear a lot about the assets that the Army has to battle fires. And that could be key, you know, with the climate change issues that we're seeing. So I don't know. I mean, because that's an argument for keeping Pohakaloa. They have something that could be helpful for the community.
Well, they should, Catherine, because it's their continued accidental burns of the valley that resulted in the trees being burnt off and the introduction of these alien grasses, which creates the situation of a high probability of more fires. So shouldn't the agency that is responsible for the threat be responsible for maintaining an effort to put out that threat? So I think they have much responsibility for the changes that they've created in the valley for, you know, more than 80 years that they've had control. And so I don't think we should let them off the hook just because they're returning one-third of the lower part of the valley. They created that situation.
And what can you say, because you at one time held or wore the hat as a chairman of the land board, as director of the Department of Land and Natural Resources. So you had a different viewpoint as well.
Well, when I sat in that chair, my responsibility was to find a way to balance everybody's needs and to balance what the law called for. Of course, now I have a different hat on, but I still see the need to have transparent discussion on the matter. And I go back to the fact that the upper two-thirds is a want of the Army and not really a need, because they have alternative places to do that training.
Well, we have seen the military and the different branches give up surplus land across the country.
I can't speak to the other places across the country. I can speak to Hawaii. So when they give up surplus land in Hawaii, it's kind of an interesting historical twist to it, because it's ceded land that they took, right? Either at the time of statehood or at the time where martial law was declared after Pearl Harbor was bombed. So returning ceded land, it's a good thing if that land can be used for productive things. But at the same time, it's also a reflection of sort of the historical wrongs that were done at that time. It's interesting in Makua, because there was fee simple lands that was also taken at the time that martial law was declared. So they told people like my uncle Ivan, don't worry, 6 years after the war, we'll return the land. So here we are, 1946, the land still hasn't been returned, although we're on the cusp of the bottom one-third being returned. We still have the two-thirds mauka of that.
That was William Ila, former state land board chairman and current member of the group Hui Malama Makua, which is a watchdog of the valley's resources. You know, we've been hearing lots about labeling of late, agricultural label laws to protect Hawaiian-grown coffee, macadamia nuts, and more recently, ahi have been backed by industry groups in recent years. But mamaki tea growers are concerned about a bill that passed this session meant to protect their industry. Here to talk about that is Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so your story highlights this bill that could have some unintended consequences.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's not clear if these consequences are intended or unintended, but the bill at least has some ambiguous language that has caused concern among people in the local tea industry, including growers.
So the farmers then are concerned because what, they don't, it could hurt them in some way?
Yes. So the issue is that the labeling requirement says that any tea, including the name mamaki, has to include 100% mamaki tea leaves. But it also makes reference to any leaves, not just mamaki leaves. And the farmers are concerned because they say our buyers like to mix in other leaves that aren't really available here in bulk in with mamaki tea and sell it. and they're concerned that these tea wholesalers and tea makers won't be able to label their tea mamaki if it contains, let's say, mint or hibiscus or anything else that they can't get in bulk here.
And, you know, it just seemed like all of a sudden mamaki tea became super popular.
Yes. Well, one of the things that the farmers talk about is shaka tea. It was a bottled, ready-to-drink tea, including mamaki and other things. And that company went out of business late last year. So suddenly this huge market for the farmers went away. And one farmer I talked to, or Matt and Andy Dreyer on the Big Island, said, look, that was a big blow to us. This bill could be the nail in the coffin for us.
So it's not clear, though, if the demand for mamaki tea is still out there. But obviously the farmers are kind of in a world of, could be in a world of hurt.
Yes. I mean, the demand seems to be growing. And again, just this morning, a farmer called me. He owns something called Oribe Tea. It's popular. Tim Johnson, he sells at Foodland, Long's, Costco. He said one of his most popular drinks or teas is something that mixes hibiscus, mint, and mamaki. And he says he won't be able to sell it. He's just not clear, based on the wording of the statute, that he's the bill that he's going to be able to sell this anymore.
So do we know if the language just changed and the public didn't get a chance to weigh in on this?
The language didn't change at all. It pretty much went through the same way all through the House, crossover the Senate, no changes. At the very end, when it went to the Ways and Means Committee, one of the tea producers, Byron Gu of Teachess Hawaii, got wind of it, and he and the Hawaii Food Manufacturers Association weighed in and said, why don't we add some language to clarify this, to protect 100% mamaki, make sure any mamaki tea product includes 100% mamaki or Hawaii-grown mamaki, but allowing us to use other things. And that just didn't happen. The language, it was too late to amend the bill.
Wow. So I imagine then they're going to be trying to lobby the governor to not to sign it if they think it might hurt their industry.
Well, it's on the governor's desk. So whether they write to him or not is up to them. But and it is there. One farmer I spoke to on the Big Island said, you know, he agreed that the language is ambiguous and probably should be tweaked to make it clear. But he liked the idea of the bill passing and thought the governor should pass it. Others have said the governor should veto it. But again, it's up to the governor at this point.
All right. Okay, well, we'll see what happens. But thank you so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton, who covers business. You can read his story at civilbeat.org.
Mexico City street DJs are famous for hosting outdoor dance parties.
Saluda al barrio bravo! La DJ Rosa Pistola.
We speak to Sonny Darrows about the tradition's roots in working class communities. That and the day's top global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Today on The Daily. For the past few days, Democrats began to undertake a painful re-examination of what went wrong with Joe Biden's presidency and his campaign for re-election. I'm Mike Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30 following Marketplace.
Thank you.
and health, how the two are intertwined. We brought you an interview with Mele Luk from the University of Hawaii Medical School yesterday. Luk helped to pioneer some of the first scientific studies into the healing powers and health benefits of dancing hula. Today, we spotlight another project investigating some of the very same questions. The UH Cancer Center is home to Nawahine Hula Akala. It's a halau composed of breast cancer survivors. It's led by Te Moana Makolo, a former professional hula dancer. And our story begins many decades ago at the Lexington Hotel in New York City. Here's HPR's Noe Tanigawa from a story that we produced back in 2014.
Back in the day, as a hula dancer, if you danced at the Royal Hawaiian and the Lexington Hotel in New York City, you'd made it to the top. Te Moana Makolo did that.
New York City, it was like a whole new ball game, you know? My knees were shaking as I entered the hotel lobby.
Oh yes, Alfred Apaka performed at the Lexington. Guests arrived in coat and tie, elegant gowns, lavish jewelry. Advertisements promised a gay, romantic evening complete with tropical hurricane.
You know, even in New York City today, people are so much more casual, right? But back in those days, oh my heavens, everybody was dressed to the hilt, you know, even if they went shopping. And so we always had to be on our toes because we were the dancers of the Hawaiian robe.
Young Hawaiians, barely in their 20s, suddenly had great jobs in New York City and a lot to learn. Makolo remembers a young friend who at first wanted to cling to her mu'umu.
Soon enough, she got to be one of the beauties. And first thing she did was she went out with her first paycheck and bought a leopard coat to get in the swing of being in New York.
The stage had thatch walls, imitation coconut trees, and dancers and musicians who knew what they were doing, according to filmmaker Anne-Marie Kirk, who's working on a documentary about the Hawaiian room.
In Hollywood films, you see the Hollywood version of hula, but in the Hawaiian room, you actually see hula dancers who are trained from court dancers, traditionally trained, as were the musicians. So you were seeing authentic hula.
The performers were full-time ambassadors and teachers, too.
They really thought we still lived in grass shacks and went swimming every day and, you know, had a real carefree life.
In fact, profound changes were underway in Hawaii as it moved towards statehood in the course of the Hawaiian Room's 30 years. It finally closed in 1967. According to Miley Liu, founder of the Hula Preservation Society, some of the spunky Lexington performers stayed on the East Coast.
And these women entreed into being entrepreneurs and establishing these businesses that are based in some way, you know, in the culture, whether it was fashion, teaching hula. And it also, was for many of them, was a stepping stone to travel the rest of the world.
Generations were intoxicated by the vision of Hawaii these many performers portrayed over the years.
Actually, what they did is shared aloha, Hawaiian music, and Hawaiian dance with a worldwide audience. And I think today, as we see halaus around the world and hula around the world, it really gets its genesis back in the Hawaiian room.
Does us good to remember the way we were. Or were we? Noe Tanigawa for Hawaii Public Radio.
And Makolo was tapped to lead a new halau in 2014. It was to be part of a pilot study measuring the benefits of hula for cancer survivors. More than a decade later, and dozens of women have taken part in this halau. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Makolo, UH Cancer Center's Dr. Aaron Bantam, and halau member Carol Lum. Makolo starts us off.
My aunt, the kumuhula, Leilani Alama, was the one who initially was to have done it. But unfortunately, she passed away months just before the study was to begin. And lucky me, I got asked if I would then do it, which of course I was happy to do so, having had cancer previously myself. That's how I got involved with it initially. And I'm very thankful to the study because over the years, I also came down with, well, I do have stage 4 bone cancer. And it has helped me tremendously because according to my oncologist, I'm beyond the period where I'm not supposed to be here anymore. So I'm very thankful to the Cancer Center that they allowed me to continue teaching the ladies as they had requested, although the programs had stopped.
growing up with hula, I saw the benefits because my aunt used to go to like these different places, senior homes, care homes, and even worked with children at Shriners Hospital. And it was marvelous how they received it. So I knew hula was beneficial to anything. And in our own studio, we had a lady who came to take hula after she had retired. So from 75 until she passed at 98 years old, she had had really bad arthritis in her hands, and hula helped her tremendously where the arthritis, I mean, she still had it, but her fingers got loose and, you know, she was able to use her hands more freely, you know.
Carol, how about you tell us a little about your journey and when you joined the halal and what that has been like for you?
Well, I saw the flyer on my oncologist's wall, so I took a picture of it, and I followed the steps, and I applied to be in the study. I was really excited because I had never danced hula before, ever, having lived here all my life. It's so much fun, and Tijuana really makes it, it's like a 360-degree thing because you learn the motions, you learn what it means, you learn what the song means, and who wrote it. And it's really a great educational and physical thing.
Is there a particular song that you like to dance to, one of your favorites?
My favorite is Puamana. My children went to a little Episcopal school in Ainahaina, and one of the Aluli family members was a Hawaiian studies teacher. And so I thought, oh, this is really interesting. And when I heard the music, I was just entranced.
See, Carol mentioned the Aluli families. One of the aunties is the one who wrote that song, Puamana. And the song is about what was their family home in Lahaina. And ironically, that seems to be the favorite of many of the ladies, you know?
Aaron, once the initial kind of studies ended, the Cancer Center did a kind of unusual thing, which is to keep the halal going, even after the research questions had been answered. So talk about that decision and what you all did from there.
Yeah, well, the impetus honestly came from the ladies because, so we ran a second study. We had that first pilot, and then we ran a second study where we also recruited people, and they attended at Polymomi in the evening, hoping to capture, invite more people in terms of the distance to the facility they were engaging in, actually after the first study, but right into the second study, the ladies came to us and said, can we keep dancing? And so it was really the impetus of them saying, we don't want to stop this, that led to the Cancer Center saying, well, yeah, that's great, especially Tamawana is donating her time to really keep teaching, and they're all showing up week after week. So it's been, in that sense, a really beautiful thing because in the scientific literature, one of the hardest things about exercise studies is the longevity. So even though physical activity really is beneficial, it's very hard to sustain. And here, even without us saying, can you do this again? Can you keep going? They came to us and said, we want to keep going. And so I think it just really speaks to kind of the impact of this type of physical activity and why it is really going to be maintained for a longer period of time. Because if we can change something short term, but it doesn't really translate, then we just don't receive the benefits. To be honest, I think the biggest and most important finding was the maintenance. So the fact that it kept going is almost more important in some ways than anything else. But to date, at this point, I would say our biggest impacts have been in the biological findings. So we've seen a lot of markers, different IL markers, going in the positive direction, and those would be related to kind of progression of disease. And so that's been extremely hopeful. We also saw changes physically, so in anthropometrics, for instance, hip waist circumference is going in a positive direction, and that circumference, kind of the density around the middle part of our body, is very much related to long-term health. So those are some of the findings we're most excited about. I don't feel like we've captured yet the impact socially. So I think we need to figure out ways to measure that. But the fact they're still all getting together socially kind of shows it. We just are not getting it yet with our data. So we need to do a better job at measuring it, I think.
Tamilana, talk about some of those social impacts or even just the ways that you've been able to see impacts on the students as they continue to be a part of the halal.
Well, we become a family. I don't know how else to say it, but the ladies all really care for one another and their families in turn, and they all take very good care of me. I had to have an operation a couple years ago, and they took it upon themselves to assign themselves on certain days to come and stay with me overnight and help care for me, which was a good thing because a week after the operation, it ended up where I had to be taken to emergency. And thank goodness I had someone there with me at the time. But yeah, we become like a big family.
We've been hearing from the woman of Nawahini Hula Akala. Hula Halau comprised of breast cancer survivors. We'll return to their conversation with HPR's Maddie Bender after a short break. Let's get back to Tamawana Makolo, Dr. Aaron Bantam, and Carol Lum. Makolo leads a hula halau for breast cancer survivors that began as a research study with the University of Hawaii Cancer Center, but has blossomed into a family. The conversations Maddie Bender asked Makolo if they ever talk about cancer, which they all have in common.
Actually, we all know we've had cancer or have cancer. I mean, because some of us are still going through treatments. But we never discuss it. I mean, yeah, we might say, I have a doctor's appointment and we're all very concerned and want to know how it's going to turn out. But other than that, it's not really up for discussion other than when's our next get together going to be? Like every so often we have what I call a birthday celebration, right? Where we all get together and we celebrate each other's birthdays for a certain period. But yeah, for me, like I said, it's been wonderful. And like, I really believe if it was not for this, perhaps I would not be here. Because according to my oncologist who shared with me a couple months back, normally bone cancer short-term survival is 24 to 28 months. Long-term survival is 2 to 5 years. Well, I think I'm in my 7th or 8th year now. And like I said, I don't even feel like I have that still. I'm still undergoing treatment for it, but I don't even think about it. And like I said, I'm very thankful for hula and for my ladies who want to keep dancing. And, you know, it's kind of fun because we also go out and perform at the senior homes. And that brings a lot of joy to all of us as well.
Carol, talk about any performances you have liked being a part of or some of the meaning there.
We enjoy dancing together, and when we have to get our act together and look good and dance well, it kind of adds to it rather than just practicing. And it's fun to see how the audience reacts, especially the seniors. Well, it's usually all seniors that we dance for, but they brighten up and they sit up straighter and they start moving their hands around. It's really gratifying.
And then just practicing, did you see any physical or emotional changes yourself as you've been doing this?
Yes, I have arthritis, and my wrists used to be really stiff, but now I can do this, and I couldn't before. They were pretty much stiff.
Yeah, and just describe, because audio.
Yeah, I can rotate my wrists 180 degrees with my hands out.
And it's very elegant the way you're doing it, too.
Before it was like pretty much just bending it at 90 degree angles. But thanks to hula, I can do that now.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of our ladies had to wear these special shoes when she first started. Now she doesn't have to do that. And like Carol said, several of them had problems with their hands or their leg or something, right? But now doesn't bother them. So hula is really beneficial to our health in many ways, in many ways.
Erin, just from the clinical side of things, do you know if there's been a push to incorporate things like hula in other places, or is it really tied to, you know, cultural and traditional understanding that that's some of the medical benefit, perhaps?
I think there's certain places on the mainland where this would fit. And a few times we've talked about maybe a multi-site study. But I think the bigger question that we've kind of tried to understand and think about in terms of more like national funding is indigenous dance. So almost everywhere, anywhere, really, there are different forms of indigenous dance, and all unique, but all would often share similar components of being group-based and of having song and move that corresponds to a story, and also the asymmetrical movement, which can be really good cognitively to have to learn those kind of things. So I think there might be something that's relevant anywhere, but it might not necessarily be hula. Hula would be great everywhere, of course, right? That we absolutely love it. But in the sense of whether it would be as relevant to the people there as maybe other types of indigenous dance.
And it really does. I mean, it combines physical activity, memorization. Mm-hmm. Timilana, like what else is
well,
involved?
Well, I mean, you have to use every part of your body. You're using your hands, you're using your feet, you're using your body in some fashion in movement. You have to use your mind because you have to memorize the choreography of the dance. Plus, I teach them the meaning of the song, who the composer was, what the intent of the composer was in writing the song. I try to give them all that information. And also besides that, they also get information about how and why things came about with the hula, because now hula is so different from when I learned it. And my style of dancing is very different from what you see a lot today. And I think that's because of the competition.
They all have to be synchronized.
Exactly. They have to be synchronized. Whereas as a former entertainer, hula dancer, we had to be synchronized, but not to the point where they're very rigid. Everybody, okay, you look this way and you have to smile at this point. Or whereas before, that all kind of just came naturally. We knew we had to put our hand a certain way or a certain height, but it wasn't where, okay, everybody, you must do it this way, which is kind of the difference I find now with hula.
And then also, I imagine accessibility might be some part of it too, working with women that have arthritis or, you know, have mm-hmm. gone through things of not making them perform
but
the
motion. You know what I find really amazing is when I watch my aunt with the children, right? You have children that's maybe they're like a slow learner or they have some disability of that sort. But yet, when you teach them the hula, like, I know this one little girl, her mom said she would go home and all day while she's home, she'd be playing her song over and over, dancing the same thing over and over. I mean, she just loved it. So that gives us the joy of seeing that happen with someone that we have taught that's in that situation.
Yeah. Carol, does it ever feel like that for you, that you go home and you're thinking of the songs that you just practiced?
Yes, and I'm old school, so I have a CD player. I have tons of Hawaiian music CD, and I put it on. And
sometimes you can dance along. Maybe not while driving.
Yeah, or people will think, if I'm stopped at a light and I do stuff, people might think, she's not all there.
And how many people have gone through the halau? How many are part of it right now?
Right now, we have about 21 or 22. But initially, I think the first group we had, what, maybe 12, Erin?
The first group was about 11, and the second group was 42 or 43. And then some of those ladies just kept dancing. And in addition, a few other ladies have come on board. Mm-hmm. So there are people now that come to the center that weren't necessarily in the study, but have had cancer mm-hmm. and have joined. So yeah, it's open in that way too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it must feel really special to have affected dozens of people's lives.
It does. It gives me such pleasure and joy. And like I said, hula has been my life. Coming from a hula family,
But seeing these ladies and what it has done or given them, the pleasure in them wanting to continue dancing and want to continue coming to hula. And a lot of it has to do with the camaraderie with everybody. So that's really nice.
I'll go around, but starting with you, Erin, what would you want listeners to know about this halal and mm-hmm. the study? I mean, any of the things we've been talking about?
Well, I guess personally for me, it's really been an honor, I would say, like as a researcher, clinical psychologist, but to see these ladies just continue living on what it is that we set out to do. And I think a big takeaway for me from this study, I have a little note next to my desk that says joy is the magnet. And I really do think that the things that we want to do regularly, the really healthy things, like we should do things that we really love that are also healthy, because I think that's the stick-to-itiveness, you know, is going to come from there. So that's a big lesson for me, is that physical activity, diet, changing health behavior, it can be really fun. And that's awesome.
Well, for me, my aunt always said, hula is love. Hula is life. And I truly believe that.
I don't quite know what to say. The first time I ever tried to dance hula, I really enjoyed it. It's all because of Temoana. And I can't believe how many years it's been. And we're all so grateful to the Cancer Center for allowing us to keep meeting, even though the studies have long been over.
That's thoughtful. Yeah, we're so grateful to you ladies for dancing.
Ah, yes. That was UH Cancer Center clinical psychologist Dr. Erin Bantum, Temoana Mokolo, and Carol Lum. They were talking to HBR's Maddie Bender about Na Wahine Hula Akala, a hula halau comprised of breast cancer survivors. Mokolo says the ladies love to perform at events. They are taking requests. And we'll have photos on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Lovely hula hands, telling of the rain in the valley, and the swirling wind over the poly. Lovely hula hands, calling Malani.
Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow we plan to take a look at innovation on the battlefield as the Army marks its 250th anniversary this year. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.